Hello, this is Elodie Reed, digital producer for Vermont Public Radio. This podcast has been edited for brevity and clarity. Yay!
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Bob Kinzel. In recent weeks, there have been several major foreign cyber attacks on sites in the United States. In one case, the flow of energy from a key southern pipeline was interrupted until a major ransom was paid. And in another case, the operations of an international meat processing company were forced to close down. Both of these cases have been linked to sources in Russia, raising the concern that future cyber attacks could wreak havoc on this country's financial system, or a shutting down of the entire national electrical grid, or maybe even a shutting down of the internet. Have these attacks become a national security concern? That's one of the questions we have for our guest today, Congressman Peter Welch, who serves on the House Intelligence Committee, a panel that's closely investigating the threats posed by foreign cyber attacks. Congressman Welch, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Congressman Welch, you are a member of the House Intelligence Committee. I realize that you are somewhat restricted by the information that you can share with us. I really appreciate your willingness to discuss this topic in a very public setting. Just so we all understand, could you run through for us what a cyber attack actually is and how it happens?
That's when an outside actor penetrates a computer system to wreak havoc on the operator of that computer system. You mentioned Colonial Pipeline. You had an outside actor, it appears to have had origins and support in Russia, that did two things. One, it interfered with the Colonial pipeline system of billing, so they literally couldn't bill anyone, and they ended up having to stop making delivery of vital fuels. And then secondly, they did a stick-up demanding a ransom of about $4 million, which Colonial paid. So the capacity of outside actors through their essentially their expertise in computer systems have found ways to penetrate other computer systems that cause enormous harm to our society.
So these outside actors, as you describe them, have figured out a way to break into fairly secure computer systems and then put disruptive software in place?
That's right. So it literally closed down the ability of Colonial to continue distributing its product. And, you know, you can imagine the terror that happens. Let's say there's a cyber attacker that gets into, say, the retirement system, the Vermont State Retirement System, or Fidelity or Vanguard, where so many Americans have retirement systems, and lock down that information. So the amount of damage that can be done by cyber attackers, criminals, or other or state actors is immense. And all of us are completely dependent on a functioning economy that has functioning and reliable computer systems to do all of the things that have to be done. It can only be done through computers and computer softwares and hardware that can't be penetrated.
As you mentioned in the Colonial Pipeline case, I think a ransom of somewhere between $4 and $5 million was paid. What's the thinking on the House Intelligence Committee? Should ransoms be paid? Because there's some people who say, don't pay the ransom, and that's one way to make these things stop. But other people say, you know, that's a very dangerous route to go down because things are going to get very disrupted. What do you think?
Well, they're both right. You know, Director Wray of the FBI put it well. He said it's the official policy not to pay the ransom. That's the obvious thing, because you pay a ransom, you encourage the criminals to do it again and collect more. On the other hand, he was aware of the real-world decisions. Let's say it's a hospital that literally has patients that are about to be operated on, and you can't get access to a computer system that allows for the delivery of the care that's required. The executive at that hospital has to make a real-world decision about the ransom versus the health and well-being of people that she may be in charge of. Or in the case of Colonial a pipeline where they did pay the ransom, and that allowed the continuation of delivery, the resumption of delivery of critical fuels. And had that shutdown continued, the economic disruption and thousands of innocent people would have continued. So it's a very, very tough call. You know, in Colonial, though, there was, I think, a good model in the future. Colonial immediately contacted the FBI, and the full array of governmental authorities got involved. And as a result of that, they were actually able to track the ransom payment through Bitcoin, something that hadn't, I think, been done before, and recover a lot of the ransom, if not most of it, not all of it.
It sort of reminds me of, you know, your classic big kidnapping cases when the people who have kidnapped the person say, whatever you do, don't call the police.
Well, that's exactly right. And of course, you know, we've had these kidnappings that have occurred with ISIS, where then they want to get a ransom. And of course, you know that you don't want to reward a criminal or a terrorist with money. But if you're the family whose son or daughter is in custody, you're going to do anything you can to try to get that person back. Or, as I was saying with cyber criminals, if you're the hospital administrator, literally there's a life and death situation there. You've got competing considerations. You know, what it says is that this is going to be out there. Cyber attack is going to be out there. It's going to be state actors like Russia that are malign and have adopted this as a way of being, quote, influential, and it's criminals. And what we have to do is two things. We have to start with being defensive. That is to make our systems secure, and that requires governmental cooperation as well as private actor and sector and corporation cooperation. But a cyber security includes zero trust in the system. You set it up assuming that there's going to be an effort to crack it. Encryption on the important systems so that if somebody does break in, they can't get the data out. We've got to make our cloud more secure. We've got to use in appropriate places multi-factor identification. We have to have a cyber incident review group. These are many of the things that have to be done, and where the governmental role has to be involved is helping to set standards with our major computer companies, but also then facilitating the capacity of some of our smaller entities and smaller governments to get access to these systems without great expense. But this is an essential national security issue, economic security issue, and small business and large business security issue.
So if I understand you correctly, what the evidence and the testimony has shown so far is we really have a combination of people who are engaging in cyber attacks. We have just some good old criminals who are hitting up municipalities and hospitals and smaller entities and saying we want $500,000 or $1 million. And then we seem to have some larger actors that are playing on a world stage that could be linked to Russia. So it's sort of two things happening at once.
That's right. Russia is the state actor, and that's it's really, you know, it's not too much to say that they converge into an act of war. I mean, if you have a state actor that actually would shut down, let's say, our transmission system on the grid so that we literally couldn't be transmitting the energy that our households need, our businesses need, our transportation needs, obviously, that's what's the difference between doing that through a cyber attack versus dropping a bomb on it. The outcome is the same. Incredible pain, incredible disruption to the security and well-being of our country. So that is very serious. And, of course, President Biden is going to be seeing Putin in this trip he's on in Europe. And I know he's going to be bringing that up, and we'll see what happens. But what you're seeing is that on a global stage, there is a growing alarm about the cavalier and malicious approach that Russia is taking to utilize their cyber capabilities to disrupt life in Western democracies.
Today in the program, our guest is Congressman Peter Welch. We've been spending some time talking about cyber attacks. Other issues in front of Congress include the infrastructure bill, the Voting Rights Act, among others. What are the top priorities that you have for Congress in the coming months? Great opportunity to talk to Congressman Welch about those priorities. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Congressman, is it pretty clear from your information on the House Intelligence Committee that the cyber attacks that you mentioned, the Colonial one and also the meatpacking one, originated from inside of Russia?
There's significant evidence that there was cooperation, certainly, by Russia with the actors. So there is a clear connection, immense evidence that Russia is very much involved in the dark side attack on Colonial.
Would it be naive to think that these cyber attacks could happen without the knowledge and the approval of President Putin?
I don't think so. I mean, everything that happens with Putin, including what they just did to Navalny, right, that the protester where they tried to kill him, where they killed a dissident in England with poison, where they did the attacks in election disruption in the 2016 presidential contest between Clinton and Trump. All of those things Putin denied that he had any knowledge of. But that strains credulity to believe it, because all of these things would require approval at the highest level. So, you know, Russia is embraced tactics that are absolutely unacceptable. Murder of dissidents on foreign soil, like has happened in England. Imprisoning an internal dissident for free speech, in effect. And that's what's happened with Navalny. Setting up this system of computer hackers to disrupt our election and then have a relationship, it appears, with cyber actors that do things like shut down the Colonial delivery system on energy. So it's very, very concerning, and it is a national security threat.
Some people who are listening might be thinking, you mentioned a couple of possibilities, shutting down the electrical grid system in this country, maybe wreaking havoc with the financial system, that shutting down the internet, maybe disrupting major water systems. And some people listening might think, yeah, you know, that stuff couldn't happen. There's no way that these outside actors could get inside of these computer systems and cause that much damage. But are you saying, oh, yes, they could?
Well, I'm saying that it definitely is a possibility. And that's why at the outset I was saying we have to do these things to defend ourselves against those attacks. Number one, let's assume let's assume that there are people who want to do that if they can find a way to do it. I think any other operating assumption would be naive, whether it's a state actor or a criminal who sees the opportunity to get a big payday. So number two, what do? We have to start with the things that we can control through our own actions, and that's why setting up secure systems is ever so important. And there has to be some governmental private sector cooperation in order for to do that. The next thing is that there really does have to be diplomacy and pressure and potentially sanctions where there is clear evidence that there's a state actor that is involved for their own state reasons. And that could be Russia, it could be Iran, but whoever it may be, the more that we have cooperation among our allies to impose a punitive response for that malicious activity, the more there'll be a deterrent against that activity from happening. So this is an ongoing challenge that we have, and we've got to be vigilant and aggressive.
Let's go to our callers and start off with Jim, who's calling from New Haven. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
What's on your mind, Jim? Maybe you need to turn your radio down and just talk to us through the phone. I think that'd be the most hopeful, so that it wouldn't be a time lag.
Okay, great. Can you hear me now?
We sure can.
Okay. Yes. So my question was, I've been listening to Congressman Welch, and everything that's being said is certainly relevant. But my question really is about, why hasn't Congress done more to be proactive as opposed to reactive? What I'm hearing is things that need to be done. And we've known that cyber attacks have been happening for years now. And so why hasn't Congress been doing anything about it, or have they?
You know, the question of how to deal with this is really new. I think that the first this really came up was in the 2016 election, where we saw that there was Russian interference, where they were able to hack into the Democratic National Committee servers and then do that that dump of emails that were disruptive in the election. And the focus then was on election security, and also a concern about whether there would be an effort to try to interfere with our tallying machines. It's been recent that the action has gone towards this ransomware type of attacks. And Congress has a capacity to have policies, and I'm talking about the executive order, the president. Also, I think where we have to do more work is to set up programs that facilitate cooperation between government and the private sector, and to do things that help our small businesses make the adjustments that are required. But the bottom line is that legislators like me, I wouldn't have a clue as to how, on a practical level, to implement the encryption in our systems, in our financial sector, in our energy sector. So that's where we have to really work with folks who have the extraordinary technical skill that is required to make those systems secure. So you're seeing the private sector, of course, is very concerned about this. You know, if you're a Fidelity Investments or you're Vanguard, you're going to be hyper concerned about taking the steps you need to. But if you're a small town or you're a small hospital, you don't have the capacity to do that. So we're all in this together, and I do see this as an area where Republicans and Democrats see the same threat, and where potentially the unity that's required to have a robust response will be there. So we've got a lot of work to do, and Congress will play a role here, but it does require the full engagement of the experts who live and die by the security of their systems.
One last thought, Congressman Welch. You were talking about stronger defensive measures and government working with the private industry to strengthen these computer systems. You know, there's some folks who say it may be time to go on the offense here and maybe strike back a little bit if you want to get President Putin's attention. Maybe talk is not the way to do it, but striking back through some cyber attacks from the United States to Russia might be the way to do it. What do you think of that approach?
It's an option. I mean, if you have a provocative action by a state against us, our citizens, and a cyber attack is that, then it's fully within the rights of the United States to counter that. And it's a judgment call that has to be made. But I can tell you this, that's not off the table.
Let's talk to George, who's calling from Cambridge. Hi, George. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you. Can you hear me?
We sure can.
I'm George Putnam from Cambridge. I'm on the select board in Cambridge. There was a question earlier about what Congress could do to be proactive. I want to thank Congressman Welch for something that Congress did recently do to be proactive with respect to local governments, and that was the .gov Act that was passed in late 2020 to encourage local governments to move their websites and their email systems to the .gov top-level domain. And I wanted to ask the congressman if he could comment on that act and if he had any advice for local governments in regards to security.
Well, George, thank you. See, that's exactly the kind of thing where I think the U.S. government has to be a partner with our local governments and with our small businesses. I mean, the point of that was to allow a small town like yours, where you're really concerned about the well-being of your citizens and the expenses borne by your taxpayers, to get access to a secure system without a big expense. It's delightful to me to hear that this is an option that you all decided to take. But that's the kind of cooperation that I think we need, because small places, small businesses, small towns, you just don't have the cash to be able to hire computer experts and come in and set up systems against these Russian hackers or even local or international criminals. So that's the direction that I see us as having to take to help towns like you and small businesses around the state and around the country. Thank you, George.
George, thank you very much for your phone call and the information of how some local communities are dealing with this issue. Congressman, right before we talked to George, you were saying that some sort of offensive actions would not be off the table. Are you concerned, though, that once you go down that road, it just starts to escalate, and once you start something, there's no stopping?
I'm very concerned about that, absolutely. And that's why there would have to be an enormous amount of restraint and care and consideration. But it's really what the danger is when Russia's playing with fire. If they're facilitating cyber attacks that disrupt American life, then that creates a dynamic where there's an immense amount of pressure to take retaliatory action. And this is where the commander-in-chief obviously makes the major decisions. But the escalation is an extraordinary concern, because where does it end? So that's why I think where we have control is on the defensive measures we take, including everything from encrypting governmental systems to what George was just talking about, and creating options for smaller governments to be able to protect their systems as well. And I see that as an area that we just have to be very, very aggressive. On the offensive end, it's always an option to do a retaliatory strike, but it always has with it that danger of escalation where things go from bad to worse.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Madison, who's calling from Burlington. Hey, Madison, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. What's on your mind today?
I wanted to do a little pushback with Congressman Welch on cybersecurity, and you initially said that we didn't know. I think this goes to a lot of issues in our country that we have not been honest about. One is racial cleansing and racial injustice, and the other being cybersecurity. I see that President Obama did have a cabinet-level position for innovation and technology, which, of course, Trump did dismantle, which put us at a disadvantage. We do see Russia frequently attacking various systems, our power grid, gas systems, private companies. So I do not look at this as an individual business, state, local government, but really this is a federal issue when it comes to acts of war. So I'm pushing back on you and asking again, how would you work with your colleagues in Congress to actually put us on a very sound and protected footing, because we are all at risk for water, power, all of the systems that make our country work and keep us safe, including food.
Well, I'm in agreement with that. I mean, I think what I've been saying is that we're all incredibly vulnerable, and the governmental role here has to be one to try to make it secure. And that has to be done with the private sector as well, because that's where there's the immense amount of expertise that's required to put in counter programs and protective programs. So this is the fact is what you described, I think, has been known. And that is, if you have computer systems that are integrated into the everyday functions of life, everything from your retirement account to the flow of water, to the flow of electrons, then unless the systems that are running them are secure, we're all vulnerable. So that has been known. But the aggression by which these attacks has escalated has been intense in, I think, the last couple of years. So the role of government is to facilitate the defensive efforts that are required. And as we have been discussing, there are offensive options as well. One may be a retaliatory attack to take the most provocative response, but others are the efforts that President Biden is doing in Europe, which include talking about collective efforts on cybersecurity and the potential use of sanctions when there is an actor, a state actor, that is threatening you and me and other citizens.
Madison, do you have any thoughts on what kind of approach would be helpful to take? What kind of strategies could be adopted?
Well, I look at it this way. We have a CDC so that it could be incredibly responsive to this pandemic. We need that same sort of concentrated, focused effort, I believe, when it comes to cybersecurity from the federal level. We should not be solely dependent on the private sector. To your point, Congressman Welch, it should be in partnership with
right.
the private sector. And I think we need a dedicated department committed to it. And I know we did have someone who was working on that as far as security for our elections. Well, it needs to be, to your point, every point of contact where folks are tied in to the internet, which these days is everything.
Well, you know, I can reassure you on this. We had in the Intelligence Committee all of our national security people, the CIA, the FBI, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and others, and a very, 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 very prominent for them is protection of our computer systems, and they see that as a absolute national security interest issue of vital concern.
Congressman, one of the points that Madison was making is, you know, are the responsibilities for cybersecurity and cyber attacks spread out over any number of federal departments and agencies? And would we be better served if we had it all concentrated in one place?
I don't know the answer to that question, because there's two aspects of this about making it functional. You can have a single person, quote, in charge, but just think about how complex the systems are at the Defense Department or the State Department. And there is significant effort at coordination, because if you can have coordinated services that have coordinated defenses, that's going to really work well. But is it possible for one person to actually be able to implement all of the changes? I think there's a real value, as some of the callers, including Madison, is making, that you want to have the buck stop somewhere. Okay, so in that sense, I think it probably does make some sense. I just don't know, as I sit here talking with folks in Vermont, about what's the best practical approach. But I'll take this into consideration, and this is a primary concern that we have in government right now.
Let's talk to Chris in Londonderry. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is there any thoughts in Congress right now to get our most important systems in our country offline completely? I mean, because for decades they worked, and there was no risk of somebody, of an actor of any sort, coming in and, you know, taking down the system completely. So that's my question. Thank you.
Yeah, the answer is there is not. I mean, we're too far down the digital economy road to be able to stop and go back to, you know, the hard copy, the carbon copy world that a lot of us grew up in. So, no, I think the cyber world is here. Digital is here. Digital is expanding. You know, we're in the 5G, and they're talking about 6 or 7G. So our challenge is to adapt defensive systems, protective systems, secure systems that will allow us to take full advantage of what technology can provide us without making us vulnerable to criminal conduct or state actor conduct.
Congressman, what do you see as the next steps that the House Intelligence Committee will take to try to reduce the threat of future cyber attacks?
Well, the oversight function that we play, we've been extremely active on. And as I mentioned earlier, it's one of those few areas where there seems to be significant bipartisan cooperation. So we, on a regular basis, have security officials in and ask them, where are we? What's going on? How are you doing it? And everything that is important, especially in security, includes not just the systems, you know, systems that are protective and secure, but personnel, because the threat, to some extent, comes from someone who's trusted that penetrates the systems with permission and then uses it against us. So the personnel policies are important, as well as the computer defensive systems as well.
Let's talk to Peter in Berry City. Hey, Peter, welcome to the program.
Yes. You know, I don't understand why Putin and Russia are doing it to us. I don't hear anything about China doing anything to us with this problem.
Well, that's a good question, Congressman. From your work on the Intelligence Committee, is China also a threat when it comes to cyber attacks?
It's got the skills to be a threat, but the evidence that we have seen, not just in the Intelligence Committee, but in public sources as well, is that Russia has had the most active use of the cyber attack as a means of asserting influence. So that appears to be the principal threat. China could be, because, as you know, they have extraordinary computer skills and capabilities. By the way, in response to some of the earlier calls, including Madison, you know, the Homeland Security Department does have a cyber division, which is fundamentally directed with the responsibility of making our system secure. That's an ongoing effort day in and day out. I mean, we all know how many times we have to do updates on our iPhone, let's say. Well, the technology is changing all the time. The software is changing all the time. And that cyber division is really the one that does have fundamental responsibility for doing everything that it can possibly do to make our systems secure.
Let's go back to our callers and talk to Frick, who is calling from Brattleboro. Hey, Frick, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, Peter Wald?
Hi, Frick.
So, I'm still trying to figure out why neither you, Bernie, Pat Leahy, all of whom I've known for a long time, and public radio, I've been a listener and contributor for a long time, has absolutely steadfastly refused to even mention the words Section 8 or Housing Choice Voucher Program in a situation where the program has been operating for near 50 years now without a lot of grandstanding, but with a lot of success, has not been funded fully. It's about, depending on whose office I talk to, it's between a quarter and a third funded. And instead of reinventing the wheel with these other, you know, rental subsidies, when we have a program that works beautifully, why are we not funding it and so that we can look into the future and not have this kind of problem?
Well, Frick, you and I had an extensive conversation about this when you called me, and then I called you back personally. And you told me that apparently you own a lot of Section 8 housing. I'm a supporter of Section 8 housing. We have a significant housing challenge in this state and in this country. It's for low-income people, and it's for moderate-income people and working people as well. And in the rescue package, there was billions of dollars that are there to help with housing. Vermont, in the money that it received through the legislature and Governor Scott, allocated hundreds of millions of dollars to housing to try to make progress on what is a very, very serious issue. So, yes, I support doing all we can, but not just with Section 8, but with any policies that are going to be helpful for us to make housing affordable for Vermonters. And it's getting tougher now. I mean, we're all hearing stories about people from out of state seeing Vermont as a desirable place to own a home that they may move to or they may just use as a second home, and that's starting to boost prices, making it tougher and tougher for Vermont families to be able to afford a house. So thank you.
Thank you, Frick. It certainly is an issue we're covering at the state level as the Scott administration works out its programs going forward for affordable housing, of which millions and millions of dollars have been allocated. We'll be following how that money is spent and how effective it's been. Let's talk to Ray in Colchester. Hey, Ray, welcome to the program.
Why, thank you. Hey, Congressman, first, I'd like to thank you for your service to our state and to our nation. My question is, what are you doing personally to help bridge the divide between the Democratic Party and moderate Republicans? Thank you.
Well, two things. Number one, I have always been in the Vermont tradition that I want to work with anybody and everybody who wants to make progress. And I did that when I was in the state Senate, and I continue to do it in Congress. And even now, as we're doing the infrastructure bill, which I hope will get passed, I'm reaching out on to individual Republicans in an effort to find a way to get to yes. And I do that constantly. But having said that, the world I'm in Washington with my colleagues down there is different than the world I went to when I got elected in 2007. 139 of my colleagues, Republican colleagues, are refusing to accept that Joe Biden was the freely elected, democratically elected president of the United States. So this norm that we have all enjoyed the benefit of since the founding of our republic, that the election results are accepted and the free and transfer of power occurs, that's being challenged. And 139 of my colleagues to this day don't acknowledge that Joe Biden was the elected president. That makes it difficult. Secondly, you've got this partisanship that's really a threat to all of us. And that partisanship, I think, is exemplified by the kind of approach that Senator McConnell takes, where he said when, as you remember, President Obama was elected, he said his job was to make certain that President Obama was a one-term president. You know, in fact, I first became Senate president here in Vermont when Jim Douglas got elected. And my view, as I said to my Democratic colleagues in the state Senate at that time, is that, hey, the same people that elected us, we had a Democratic majority, elected Governor Douglas. And that's a signal from Vermonters that they want us to work together to try to make progress for the state of Vermont. And that's my view in Washington. So this disruption we have where the outcome of a free and fair election is disputed instead of embracing the free transfer of power, that trust is so essential in a democracy, that's under challenge now. And it's the biggest challenge that our country faces. We have to restore trust in our institutions and in one another. And that includes a willingness to accept that some elections we win and some elections we lose.
Congressman, there are going to be some people listening who say, you know, the Democrats have got a role in this partisanship as well. It's not a one-sided issue. What do you see as the Democrats' responsibility?
Well, our responsibility is to do what I just described. We have to work concretely on the issues. We have to listen. We have to try to negotiate. I agree with that. What's different here, Bob, because there's always been blame on both sides on this, on the partisanship question. What's different here is that you had President Trump refusing to accept the outcome of the election. And then he peddled what I can only describe as a lie, that the election was stolen. And a lot of people believe him. And the foundation of our democracy is that we accept the outcome of elections and we accept the peaceful transfer of power. And what we saw on January 6th is that the certification process whereby that peaceful transfer of power occurs was challenged. And there was violence that was embraced as a tactic to try to challenge it. And that was the mob attack on the Capitol. And as you know, I was in the gallery when the shooting started and when the mob tried to break down the big doors for entry onto the House floor. That's different. We have not had that. We haven't had that in our country. And what's so concerning to me is that the norm of democracy requires, one, peaceful transfer of power, acceptance that it's the people who decide who their leaders are, not the politicians in Congress. And number two, the renunciation of violence as a means of political persuasion. And that's different. And I've got 139 colleagues who they did vote for something that would have resulted in the overturning of the election of Joe Biden as president.
What hopes do you have that this situation is going to change any time in the near future?
We've got to keep working at it. But what I believe that at the heart of our challenge is that we restore confidence in government by having government do some of the things that people have been calling in on. You know, let's get the practical things that we need government to do, like make housing affordable, like create job opportunity that's for everybody, like have a rescue package where we get broadband to every community. And that's to communities, whether they voted for Trump or they voted for Biden. You know, there's a universality of what's happened with COVID. Everybody had a real threat to their health, and whether you were rich or poor, whether you were a Trump voter or a Biden voter, it didn't matter. You were subject to that potential health threat, and many people, unfortunately, were afflicted by it. But secondly, in the response, the things that we have to do to get Vermont back on its feet, like help our restaurants, like get broadband deployed in rural parts of our state that don't have it, like financially back up our hospitals that have been hurt real hard by COVID. All of these things are going to benefit every Vermonter, whether you are a conservative or liberal. It doesn't matter. And that's ultimately where we need to be, where we have to understand that each of us has goals and aspirations and want opportunity for ourselves, for our families. And how to do it is always a debate. That's traditionally been the debate that we have in politics. But the underlying goal is the shared goal. It's a shared goal of building our communities together. And, you know, we're so lucky in Vermont. You know, I remember when I was I had young kids, and I'd go to I'd be at town meeting, and I'd be having an argument with one of my neighbors. And then I'd go out to the baseball field, and that neighbor who we were just arguing with is coaching my son at Little League. You know, and you have these personal relationships, and it reminds you of what's really fundamentally important, and that is reinforcing our common humanity. And that's the challenge we face in Washington, and it's the challenge a lot of us face wherever it is we live or work.
Let me ask you this question before we run out of time. The infrastructure package passed the House. It's something that President Biden has been proposing. There's some fight in the Senate between the Republicans and the Democrats over the size of that package. Perhaps if there is a compromise, that package might be half the size of what passed the House. What would your advice be to the Democratic leadership in the Senate? Take what you can get, or if you can't get enough, don't get anything.
No, I want us to make progress. So I've been totally supportive of good faith negotiations. I'm totally supportive of a good faith compromise. I think there's some principles here. You know, compromising on the amount is what you do in politics. I do think we have to pay for it. And one of the big resistances on the part of Senator McConnell is that he does not want to pay for it, basically. And I do think that potholes don't fix themselves. And we've got a neglected infrastructure, and I think it's going to really be helpful to our country if we have an ambitious infrastructure program. But I do think we should be paying for it, and I think the right way to do it is, you know, billionaires who don't pay any taxes. You know, Jeff Bezos not only didn't pay taxes one of those years, but he got a $4,000 tax credit for his two kids. I mean, that's a tax system that's not working. Or some of these multinational corporations like Nike. Now, if you bought a pair of Nike shoes, you paid more for those shoes or sneakers than Nike paid in corporate income taxes. So shouldn't the folks who are making lots and lots of money but not paying anything be asked to pay a fair share to help us get our roads and bridges and broadband, the things we need and would be helpful to the entire country? Can't they contribute? So I think that's important. But yes, negotiate, and if we can reach a reasonable compromise, I'll be supportive of it.
Do you think the disclosure this week that some of the richest Americans didn't pay any income taxes will start to move Congress in that direction?
Well, I sure hope so. I mean, we're all entitled to a fair tax system, but it's not a fair tax system if people literally who make billions of dollars don't pay any taxes. It's not a fair tax system if some of the most successful corporations are able to, through accounting measures, avoid paying any taxes. You know, our small businesses here in Vermont, they pay taxes. You know, some of our tourist industry, they pay taxes. Our restaurants, they pay taxes. Those folks are working really hard, and they're doing things that are really good for our communities, and they're paying their fair share. And it is really shocking and completely unacceptable to me that a guy like Bezos or other billionaires can game the system so they don't have to pay. And they do it legally. So this is up to Congress to change it.
Well, we've covered a lot of important issues on the program today. Many thanks to Congressman Peter Welch for taking the time to be with us. Congressman, we really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, and thanks to all the listeners and all the callers. Thank you very much. We're going to make progress.